Hello and welcome to the Brentas Foundation podcast, where we throw light on some of the African continent's biggest and most pressing issues and leverage best practice, not just on what to do, but how to do it. I'm your host, Marie Noah Ngoklo, and it's a pleasure to share in this moment with you. Joining me for today's episode is Rolf Meyer. Rolf Meyer was one of the principal architects of the South African transition from apartheid to democracy. As Minister of Constitutional Affairs, Mr. Meyer led the negotiations that resulted in the first democratic elections in South Africa at the end of April 1994. In this capacity, he negotiated the end of apartheid together with current President Cyril Ramaphosa, who was then chief negotiator for the African National Congress, the ANC. After the election, Mr. Meyer continued in his portfolio of constitutional affairs in the cabinet of then President Nelson Mandela. Today, Mr. Meyer is currently a management consultant and serves on the boards of various companies and acts as a consultant on peace processes and constitution making. In this capacity, he's been involved in various regions around the world, including Northern Ireland, Sri Lanka, Rwanda, Burundi, and even the US, as you hear in this episode. In 2009, President Motlanthe awarded Mr. Meyer the Order of the Baobab in silver for his immense contribution in providing special support in the birth of the new democratic South Africa through negotiations and ensuring that South Africa has a constitution that protects all its citizens. This conversation was sobering, it was enlightening, and helpful, especially for many young Africans who are a little removed from the realities of three decades ago, especially outside South Africa. So I hope you learn a lot from it. I hope you enjoy the chat. And without further ado, let's get straight into the chat with Mr. Rolf Meyer. So Rolf Meyer, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me today. How are you doing?
I'm very good, thank you. It's pretty hot in Pretoria, but It's summertime. We should not complain.
See, I definitely have a different experience here in Lilongwe. It's quite hot, but it's also serene and windy because it's very green, actually. So
they get lots of rain in that area.
They do. Yes, we definitely do on the side. All right. So to get us started, can you walk me through the very first time, right, you were told that you'll become like chief negotiator for President de Klerk in the talks to end apartheid? Do you remember where you were and what that experience was like?
Well, that's a that's an interesting question.
You weren't ready for that one, were you?
I was part of the government's negotiating team right from the start when President de Klerk took over as leader of the country in 1989. He confirmed my position that I had at that stage, which was Deputy Minister of Constitutional Affairs, and I continued in the same position I had before then, and the new minister was Dr. Gerrit Viljoen. So I immediately became part of the government preparatory team that had to start taking decisions on the way forward. That team was called the government's Ministerial Committee on Negotiations. That was the name of the team, Ministerial Committee on Negotiations, and I was the youngest member of the team. And therefore also the scribe of that committee. Why I'm telling this is just to say that I was part and parcel of the preparations, the decision-making around the release of President Mandela, the unbanning of the organizations and so forth. And I remained part of that committee right up to the end of the completion of all the negotiations. It so happened that during the unfolding of the talks and the start of the dialogue, we went through all the processes of talks about talks, real talks, dialogue, and then, of course, negotiations. during all of that, I was part of this team, but in my capacity as the deputy to the government negotiating leader, who was Dr. Gerrit Viljoen. And then in May of 1992, Dr. Viljoen became unhealthy. He was not able to continue with his role in that regard. And President de Klerk then decided to replace him as the Minister of Constitutional Affairs and appointed me in that capacity and sort of automatically becoming the chief negotiator for the government team. I would say it was not a complete surprise for me, simply because I was part of the team. It could have been anybody else for that matter. I would have stayed on as part of the team. It is just my responsibilities and my task became different. I then could concentrate fully and only on the negotiations. And you know, I guess if I had to become chief negotiator completely from the outside, it would have been a different case.
Right.
But since I was part of the team right from the beginning, it was not so much of a shock. Mm-hmm. I had the privilege of being ingrained into the situation already by then. Sorry, that's a long answer.
No, but it's perfect. Thank you for that. All right. So in terms of the peace process, right, we know that, you know, every sort of peace process faces its share of challenges. Were there particular moments that have stuck with you? And how did you sort of manage the negotiating parties? How did you overcome that in terms of sort of the mini talks about talks and the dialogues that went on? Is there anything that really stuck with you as like, that was a very interesting conversation or time?
There were many of those. but
delight us with one.
but can I just, you know, again give some context? For the sake of explaining what were the difficult moments and what were the main challenges.
Mm-hmm, sure.
I maintain that in all successful negotiations, there has to be a moment of irreversibility. In other words, where the parties can't turn back, where it's almost enforced upon them to continue and go forward and finding answers. And I think we were fortunate in the sense that a moment of irreversibility was right at the beginning. And that was when President Mandela was released from prison. That was the moment of irreversibility. When he came out of prison, there was no way that he would go back or could be put back into prison. It was right. A moment of determining the future, moment of irreversibility. And I think I say this because I think it was very helpful for us, having had that experience, having had that knowledge that we have to go forward. Also, when breakdowns happened and there were major challenges to the process, we simply knew that we could not go back. We had to find a way going forward. And in that sense, the breakdown of the negotiations in June of 1992, and this was just a month after I took over as the chief negotiator, when the breakdown of negotiations happened, and fortunately, I can say it was not because of my appointment that it happened, but it was because President Mandela and the ANC then decided that they couldn't continue with the negotiations on the slate that we had developed, and he called it off and said, I can't trust this government any longer. I can't negotiate with them. And the reason that was given is that the government was involved in all sorts of support for rogue elements and so forth. And, you know, that is why President Mandela said he couldn't trust his government any longer. I don't think that was the real reason, but nevertheless, the negotiations broke down and we had to start from scratch. And it was a devastating moment, as you can imagine, because now suddenly we had to go back to the drawing board and ask ourselves, what do we do next? We couldn't go back to where we started 2.5 years earlier. There was no way, like I said, to return President Mandela to prison. So we had to find a way going forward. And the next 3 months that followed, from June of 92 to September of 92, I think were crucial, was the most crucial period in our negotiations. I was fortunate to be part of it, to be present, but also it was very scary because we had to delve very deep and finding the answers that were not always visible. But it so happened that in that period, the real settlement, I think we can say, of the South African problem came forward, and we resolved the breakdown by getting back to the negotiating table. And that was a major experience, a major lesson for us all, but also something to share with others in conflict situations around the world on how we did it.
Yeah. And what was that, you know, real settlement, and what did it look like to regain, sort of, if I can put it as like the confidence or trust for them, Nelson Mandela and team, to come back to the table? What did it take, and what did that teach you about negotiating peace?
Well, it came from both sides, so it was a joint effort. We had to look from our side at what had to be done. The ANC, of course, had their own methods, and they also had to delve into their own positions and try to mobilize people behind them, which they did through what was called the rolling mass action in that period that followed. It was a very tense period, those 3 months. But the reason why we succeeded in getting back to the table was it was unfolding because of a direct channel of communication between the chief negotiator for the ANC at the time, Cyril Ramaphosa, and myself, and a very small team on both sides, that we succeeded in getting over the hurdle. And that was to establish the answer in terms of, where do we go into the future? What is it that we want from the future? What is it that we want from a future constitution? Instead of looking back and say, what is it that we want to protect from the past? And I would say that mind shift was fundamental to finding the answer. And once we could agree on that common vision for the future, it was possible for both sides, ANC and the government, to return to the negotiations and resume it, not only on a fictitious basis, but on a real visionary basis, as it was determined through what became known as the Record of Understanding that was signed by Mandela and de Klerk in September of 1992.
Thanks for sharing that. And I know you've been involved in peace processes, right, in other places. I think at Northern Ireland, even Rwanda. What have you found to be sort of common with, you know, all these experiences? Are there any commonalities, and what is strikingly sort of different about these experiences?
I would say there are three things that one can determine as to what came out of our success story that I find would always be relevant in other conflict situations. And the one is that we had a very inclusive process in South Africa. And the second is that we succeeded in building trust between the opposing sides. And thirdly, we succeeded in taking ownership and responsibility ourselves of what we had to resolve. And we also took responsibility for the outcome of what we resolved. I think those were the three key elements that helped us to bring about success in South Africa's case. And what I would think is, in terms of my experience in so many other conflict situations, ongoingly still even today, is that where those three factors are not in alignment, where they are not resolved, those three factors, then the conflict is not necessarily resolved at all. So those are the common factors that I think, to my mind, overwhelms all the other key issues that might come forward. But at the same time, I have to make special mention of the fact that we have to admit all conflicts are different. What we have experienced in South Africa, of course, is different from what other conflicts might produce. Mm-hmm. Each one has its own unique circumstances, and you have to recognize that. And again, from my work that I've done in other conflict situations, I think there are three main causes for conflict. The one is of an ethnic divide, the second is of a religious divide, and the third one is just basic greed for power or greed for economic advantage. And one has to every time analyze the cause of that conflict and then adjust your sharing of experience with those in those conflicts and try to find the right answers and give the right, I would not say advice, but at least sharing of relevant experiences that come across.
Mm-hmm. You know, and sort of coming back to the South African peace process, right? I can imagine that involved significant sort of compromises and this commitment to inclusivity, which you mentioned before. How can some of the principles of, like, you know, inclusivity and compromise be applied to address some of the current global issues that we face, right? Especially considering the very diverse perspectives that exist in today's interconnected world and the seemingly polarization around issues and whose side somebody is on.
Yeah, you're absolutely right in asking that question. And the answer is not obvious. I happen to share our experience in many other conflict situations right now, including the United States of America. And I hesitate in saying that, but we've been asked, myself and one of my colleagues, to share our experience with communities, with those concerned about the situation, specifically in the United States, because of the polarized environment that people find themselves in that country. But the same phenomenon plays out in many other countries and globally as a whole. So, you know, we live suddenly in a far more polarized world than the case was 20 years ago or in the immediate period after the end of the Cold War. And on the one side, you know, there are democratic forces, and on the other side, there are autocratic forces, as we all observe. And the sad thing is that autocracy is probably on the rise and democracy is on the retreat. So how can we address this and what contribution we can make? I don't think there are easy answers. But what we know that helped us in South Africa is that we succeeded in finding common ground in the center between people with different views, with completely opposite persuasions, between black and white. And I think we were fortunate to have the leadership that gave direction to build that center or middle ground. And in the process, we could fight off the marginal segments of society that were fighting against finding a solution. We succeeded in marginalizing the extremes, both left and right, and I think that is the message that we have to carry through to reasonable people elsewhere in the world, and to say, carry on with the message that there is an answer, and build the strong center around that message of hope, of reason, and of bridging the divides that might exist in societies. Sometimes the divides are perceived. Sometimes it's based on unnecessary differences. And I think that can only be countered if we really succeed in building a strong center. Recognizing differences, recognizing different persuasions, but at least that, or at the same time recognize that the center is stronger than the margins on the left or the right.
No, that's very important. And one of the things I actually wanted to talk to you about was like the sort of the role of, you know, effective leadership and even just the idea of leadership in itself. Speaking now to, you know, current leaders, speaking to, you know, sort of young leaders, people who are looking to go into politics, political diplomacy, you know, leveraging these experiences, right, and navigating the complexities of the South African peace process, among the many others. How can leaders today apply those lessons to foster dialogue and understanding, again, in the face of sort of the global challenges we face now? And what are some of those characteristics that people need to hone to be able to manage the world that we live in now?
You know, we often experience that when we go into conflict situations and share our experience, people would say, but we don't have a Mandela, you know, and the answer to that we try to give all the time is to say, but, you know, go and look what Mandela did and try to become little Mandelas, you know, practice what he did. In the South African case, he was an amazing example, as far as that is, of leadership and of generosity and every good thing that you can think about. So I think the examples are there. But in real terms, to be pragmatic about this, I keep on thinking, you know, people like us had to find our own answers as we were going through the motions of the negotiating process in South Africa. And if I think about my own experience in that regard, I think it is, first of all, important to analyze the problem for what it is. In South Africa's case, it was about politics. It was about ensuring that every South African is entitled to the same rights as anybody else in this country. It was about political rights in the first instance. So analyze the problem. And secondly, then based on your analysis, go forward and seek the answer, seek the solution, and do what is necessary to rectify the problem. So what I'm saying is, you know, I think leadership can be exercised in the best possible way if people analyze the problem and then come up with clear thinking about what can produce the right answer and result and solution.
And there's this saying I hear often, and I'm curious to know what you think about this. And it's this idea that sort of the best solution or agreement is usually when you leave both sides a little bit unhappy. Have you found that to be true?
Absolutely. You know, even today when I hear people are accusing me of being a traitor of the white community, and I hear people who say Mandela was a traitor of the black community, I know that we have been on the right track. We did what was necessary to find the right answers. You know, it's a little bit of give. It's a little bit of compromise. No solution has a perfect answer or produce a perfect answer. But if the majority and if the composition of the solution is such that it satisfies the majority of thinking, then at least you have an answer. Maybe our concept of sufficient consensus therefore reflects best what we try to do in the South African case, sufficient consensus.
Yeah. And as we wrap this up, Mr. May, I was wondering, what do you wish you knew then that you know now about negotiating peace?
I indicated, you know, we followed the process of learn by experience.
Yeah.
You know, as we moved forward, we were in the learning process all the time. And of course, that process of learning is never complete. 30 years later, I can say I'm sitting here and I know there are a lot of things that I'm still learning every day. Some of it might not have been applicable at the time. You do what you do under given circumstances and when the window of opportunity produces itself. If we were waiting forever to start the process in South Africa, we would have seen bloodshed and conflict and civil war. Mm. So it was the right thing to get the process underway and to do the best we could. But there's one thing I would admit looking back, and that is that we should not have stopped with the negotiations on finalizing the Constitution. I think we should have carried on in asking ourselves the question, how do we implement this? We have a beautiful constitution in South Africa, but it's not being implemented to the full. Yeah. And as a result of that, many South Africans would rightfully and legitimately complain today that they don't see the value of the constitution because it's on paper, but it's not in practice. And I think one thing that we could have done and should have done was to actually go back after we completed the Constitution to ask ourselves the question, how are we going to ensure that this beautiful Constitution is going to be implemented in terms of what its directives are, its imperatives are? And I think that was a shortcoming.
Yeah. And if you were to revisit that sort of conversations, what are some of the key tenets that you need to ensure are outlined in implementing this to make it work for all South Africans?
Well, if I can take two key issues that are coming up frequently in debates, and the one is land reform and the other one is black economic empowerment. And I think in both cases, the models that were prescribed in the Constitution to be followed, the imperatives in the Constitution are there, but I think the implementation fell short because the policy positions that were evolved after the Constitution to make provision for, let's take the example of black economic empowerment, fell short of empowering the vast majority of South Africans. One can say the elite benefited hugely from those policies, but it was not widespread and it's still not widespread. And I think that is the kind of shortcoming that we're talking about. There are many others, but I use that as an example.
Mm-hmm. Rolf Meyer, thank you so very much for giving me a bit of your time today. I know you do have a busy schedule, so I don't take it lightly. It was wonderful having you on the podcast, and hopefully we can do this again some other time.
Thank you very much for inviting me, and it was a real pleasure talking to you.
That brings us to the end of today's show. I hope you enjoyed it as much as I did putting it together. I love learning new things. Hey, if you enjoyed this chat, you definitely enjoy others that came before it. Check out previous episodes on whichever platform you're tuned into now, or visit our website www.thebrenthurstfoundation.org for other episodes. As always, thank you so much for listening. And if I could make one last ask of you, please do share this with others. Again, you're listening to Marie Noel on the Brenthurst Foundation podcast, and it's been a pleasure sharing this time with you. Until next week, stay well.